Okay, we'll get started with the next segment, and just want to finish a couple of slides from this morning's lecture as we move into instrumentation. We left this in talking about scintillation detectors. Scintillation detectors are those that produce the flashes of light dependent upon the energy deposited in them, which then is converted to an electronic signal. So we have energy discrimination capabilities, meaning we can generate, when we expose this detector to radiation, an energy spectrum. And that energy spectrum will have a peak at the photopeak energy, or at the primary energy of the emission of the radionuclide, and then it will have a range of energies below that which represent the range of Compton scatters. And one of the key things that we would do with detectors is measure the effectiveness of the detector in those energy conversions using the full width half max. So I know you've heard of this, but make sure that you're familiar with this before the board exam. That's simply measuring the width of the photopeak at one half of its maximum. So the wider that is, the more errors of energy conversion you have, and the poorer the energy resolution. So just remember, it's a low score. It's like a golf. The lower golf score, the lower the number, the better. So you can either do full width half max, which just measures the width of that photopeak at half of its maximum. And if you divide that by the photopeak energy and multiply by 100%, you get a percent full width half max. Now, and the other key thing to remember about sodium iodide crystals, if you look at the energy that you expose the crystal to and the full width, percent full width half max, and just forget about the yellow line here, the red line shows you that the lowest full width half maximum values for scintillation crystals are between 100 and 200 keV, meaning that's where sodium iodide scintillation detectors are most effective. So thallium is below that 100 keV lower threshold. Okay, key thing to remember. Another reason why thallium images don't look as good, because the detector is not as efficient in converting those low energies. Now, the spectrum can also be used to characterize scatter. There are two spectra here. One bordered by a dashed line, the other bordered by a solid line. The only difference between these two spectra is that the spectra bordered by the dashed line has only air between the source and the detector. The darkened line has 4 centimeters of plastic, which basically is about one half value layer of tissue. And you see that what happens are counts in the photopeak go down when scatter is added, and the area beneath the scatter goes up. Key thing to remember when you are talking about sodium iodide detectors in the context of spectroscopy. So the voltage pulse is essentially a reflection of energy. The scatter in the source will increase the amount of photons that we see in the Compton scatter region, which by nature will decrease those photons that are registered in the photopeak. And the X-ray detection efficiency, or the gamma ray detection efficiency, is certainly going to be dependent upon the thickness of the crystal. Now, I should also mention a third detection strategy is semiconductor detectors. They originally were germanium lithium and silicon lithium detectors. Now we use CZT, the cadmium zirconium telluride detectors, and these detectors work by direct detection. Basically, a semiconductor material is a material that may or may not conduct or produce a current dependent upon any energy conditions that it's exposed to. So if we have a semiconductor detector, we expose it to radiation, and that radiation is of sufficient energy that it produces a current, then that current will be a reflection of the energy of that gamma photon, and we oops, don't know what happened there. It is a so semiconductor materials are materials. Can you put that back in presentation mode for me? Thank you. That will produce very nice spectra because they have less error in the energy conversion. So if you compare the full width half max of a sodium iodide crystal at the technetium energy with a semiconductor material, you see that its energy resolution is better, as indicated by this narrower photon. Now, you'll see a couple of questions on the board exam about semiconductor detectors, even though it's known that they're not in widespread use yet, and that's mostly from economic conditions, but be aware that it's a means of detection that uses a semiconductor, which then absorbs energy and produces a current that's analogous to that energy. Okay, now we can move on to talking specifically about scintillation cameras, which takes our scintillation strategy and builds an imaging device. So all we really do in that case is we have a large crystal, and on the back of that crystal are a number of photomultiplier tubes. Remember, that photomultiplier tube takes the flash of light and turns it into a current, and then between the source, which would be here, and the detector, which would be here, we have a collimator, which is nothing more than a piece of lead with parallel or with holes bored in it, the septa between the holes being thick enough to attenuate photons that are traveling at angles. So now we have a large crystal which produces flashes of light underneath a specific photomultiplier tube or a group of photomultiplier tubes that are in an XY orientation to one another. Now our signals not only give us this energy footprint of the scintillation, but also a spatial footprint as to where they occurred in the field of view of the camera. Look something like this. This is looking through the backside of the crystal. You see it looks like it's white because the canister that surrounds the crystal is painted with a highly reflective paint. This is a perfectly clear piece of either optical glass or optical lucite. Photomultiplier tubes are attached to it. On the patient side of the detector is an array of all the photomultiplier tubes so that calibrations and measurements of the performance of those can be done by service engineers. So one of our challenges is to take this XYZ pulse and put it into an electronic scheme that then would populate an image that correlates to where it was detected in the field of view of the camera. It's actually fairly simply done. The photomultiplier tubes that are closest to a particular scintillation will produce the highest signals. We take these signals, and once we discriminate their energies by the pulse height analyzer, we know that they're not scattered photons through that process. Then we simply add up all the X and Y location signals from those, send them through an analog digital converter, and we produce a bit code for the X and Y positions of those, which are simply placed into the XY matrix of the digital signal. So what happens is we're producing signals based upon Cartesian coordinates. We have the field of view divided up into XY coordinates, and as a signal goes further and further out the plus X and further up the positive Y axis, we will produce signals of higher amplitude in those spatial locations. And so these combinations of positive and negative X, positive and negative Y signals then produce the digital code that allows us to address that into a digital matrix. Now, what we know about scintillation cameras is that they are not inherently non-uniform in their response. The crystals are not perfect in producing flashes of light that correlate with energies. There's some error involved. Photomultiplier tubes are not absolutely reproducible in producing an electronic signal or a voltage pulse that relates to those scintillations. So that leads to a non-uniformity of response of the detector. So if we took a sodium iodide detector, on a camera and we uniformly irradiated it, we would not produce a picture of uniform densities because of these errors. So to get past these errors or correct for them, we have to take three approaches. We have to correct for the energy variabilities or those energy conversion errors. We have to correct for some non-linearity attributes that are present in photomultiplier tubes. And then we can do some further uniformity correction on the digital image to better improve the performance of the gamma camera. So for energy correction, what we've noted is that if we look at the position of the individual photopeaks from individual photomultiplier tubes, you'll find that those peaks will not all line up on a common energy axis, meaning that there are some errors and they're not expressing those photoelectrically absorbed photons and producing reproducible signals. When we add all of those photopeaks together within the energy window of the camera, we will reflect the splay or the variability of those positional of the photopeaks in a spectrum that has a very wide full width half max. Well, that's a reflection of error, so we don't want to get rid of that error. And we can do that by energy correction, where we electronically shift all of these photopeaks so that they all line up along a common energy axis within the energy window of the camera, thus, when added together, decrease the full width half max. So that improves this variability that's inherent in the energy conversion process in the gamma cameras by simply aligning all the photopeaks up by using electronic correction factors along a common energy axis. What does that mean to you? Well, if your ability to see two points in space is your ability to resolve contrast between those two points in space, and if the full width half max of the photopeak is then a reflection of your ability to see two points in spatial space as opposed to energy space, then you would want the full width half maximum values to be as low as possible, which would then produce the highest possible contrast between your two points in space. So before we do energy correction and we have wide full width half maxima values, you would see these two points in space with this much contrast. After we do energy conversion, narrow the full width half maximum values of the individual photomultiplier tubes, we see those same two points with this much contrast. So energy resolution is directly tied to your contrast resolution of a gamma camera. So that's why that is so important. So if I uniformly irradiate the field of view of a gamma camera coming right off the assembly line, and I take a picture of that, I should see a uniform density of an image. That image is usually referred to as the flood image because we flooded the field of view with a uniform density. And when I take a picture of this camera before I do energy conversion, I get nothing that approaches a uniform image. In fact, I see the photomultiplier tubes as dark spots, the areas between those dark spots as higher intensity areas, and the dark spots that represent the position of the photomultiplier tubes are not even the same intensity. I apply energy conversion, where I line all of those photopeaks, all of those photomultiplier tubes up to a common energy value, and now I see that each photomultiplier tube has the same intensity of compared to one another, but they're not the same intensity compared to the areas between them. So even though we did energy correction and made the photomultiplier tube response more reproducible, we have done nothing to produce this inherent property of non-uniformity of imaging. So we got to do something else, and we've got to explain that. Well, we do that through an inherent factor in photomultiplier tubes is that they are not linear in their response across the face of the photomultiplier tube. If I uniformly irradiate a single photomultiplier tube with a uniform flux of visible light, the signals vary as a function of where those signals interacted with the photomultiplier tube, and they vary in a nonlinear way. The ones in the center produce less of a signal than the ones at the edge. And if you go back, if I go back and look at this previous image, you can actually see that. You can see that the photomultiplier tubes are variable in response, but now that we've corrected them, they're darker. They produce less counts in the center as they do towards their edge. Oop. So if we can calculate what this nonlinearity wedge is here, or this nonlinear response based upon where in the photomultiplier tube these interactions took place, we can correct for those by simply electronically filling in this gap with a correction factor. And now when I take my flood image, I go from this, which is only energy corrected, I apply this linearity correction factor that corrects for the nonlinearity of the photomultiplier tubes, and now I get an image that looks uniform in its intensity, more accurately than reflecting the uniform flux of radiation that it's exposed to. Now you can take a picture of a myocardial perfusion image, and changes in intensity would reflect changes in distribution of blood flow as opposed to changes in the instrument performance. So we've taken a big step forward when we combine energy correction with linearity correction. Well, as it turns out, if we expose our detector to a uniform flux of radiation and we put some type of phantom in between the source and the detector, we can actually measure what those nonlinearities of response are, and we can compute the differences that we see in our image as compared to our phantom, and we can produce a linearity correction map, and that will then be applied to all images on the fly from that point on. That's done at the factory. Okay, so the factory comes in with energy correction loaded, with linearity correction loaded, and the third thing that we want to do then is look at further assessing any subtle non-uniformities that would be in our digital image. And what we'll want to do that is, again, uniformly irradiate the detector with a uniform flux of radiation, acquire an image into a digital matrix that has a lot of counts in it because, again, we're trying to minimize statistical variations, and we simply look at each individual pixel value. We calculate an average of those pixel values, and we then divide that average by the individual pixel values to see how much subtle variations we have on a pixel-by-pixel basis in this uniformity correction image. We store those differences into a correction map, and that correction map is again coupled with the uniform with the energy linearity, with the energy correction and the linearity correction to produce even a more uniform image than we saw when we just corrected for nonlinearity. So these three corrections, energy, linearity, and uniformity, are done at the factory. They're customized, they're inherent to an individual instrument, and your responsibility once you take possession of this camera is to build a quality assurance model around the assessment of those three correction factors. So these correction factors, when we look at those effects on the uniformity of a gamma camera, and again, that's the most critical attribute. You don't want non-uniformities in intensities of the images you're interpreting to be due to the camera. You want them to be due to different biodistributions of the radionuclide. So if we do no corrections, these cameras have 20 to 30% non-uniformity inherently. When we do the energy correction, we still have a significant amount of spatial non-uniformity. We combine energy and linearity correction, we make a big step forward, we drop that inherent non-uniformity down to 5 to 10%, and then when we do that pixel by pixel correction of the digital image for non-uniformity, we improve that value even further to 2 to 5% variation. And that's the goal that you want to achieve, and that's where you test in your quality control program, is to see how close to that sort of magic 5% variability that you really can't get any better than. The principles of gamma cameras are largely unchanged for 40 years. The new digital cameras that take those signals that come off the photomultiplier tubes and digitize them give us a little bit more opportunity to do better corrections and more stable performance of the gamma cameras. But future gamma cameras will likely move away from scintillation. All right, they may move to new crystals like the LSO crystals. It's just a different type of crystal which has a little bit better full width half maximum performance than sodium iodide. But most likely, and this will be somewhat based on economic conditions, we'll see the deployment of CZT detectors, because we know that their full width half maximum values, their energy resolution values, are better than any scintillation crystal. Now, as an aside, addendum to looking at the general single photon strategies using scintillation cameras, we really take kind of the basic sciences of that and apply those to positron emission machines. But now what we do is we arrange an array of detectors around the patient. Okay, so we have a hole here, and in around that hole are bordered a ring of scintillation detectors using a different scintillator, not sodium iodide, but one that's more efficient for the 511 keV photons, each of which is engineered 180 degrees apart from another detector, so that the near simultaneity of firing or producing a signal of these two detectors is a reflection of the detection of the two annihilation photons coming from the annihilation of the positron. We then do a very high temporal resolution analysis of that to see where along this 180 degree line the scintillation actually occurred. So we actually calculate slight differences in the time of flight from the point of origin. So it's a very effective imaging technique, because we are constantly getting signals in a whole array of detectors. We're getting two photons per scintillation in each of those detectors to locate along that axis where that scintillation occurs, and that gives us much better contrast resolution as well as spatial resolution as compared to single photon techniques. Now, some physical characteristics of scintillation crystals are designated here. LSO, GSO, and BGO are typical crystals that are used in positron detectors, and I put sodium iodide up here so you can see the difference. The effective Z number, or the stopping power of the sodium iodide crystal, is about 51. And look how much higher the Z numbers are of these other crystals. That makes sense. We're now detecting photons that are 511 keV as opposed to 140 keV, so we need a higher Z number. And we'll also see different densities up here, physical densities as well as Z numbers. So the strategy is similar, but the scintillations are different, and the engineering of the detectors are different. We have this ring of detectors, and now our job really becomes not looking at variations in the spatial distribution, but variations in the temporal distribution or the temporal firing of all of these detectors when a scintillation is detected. So our considerations for quality are a little bit different. We have some bad events that will occur in PET imaging. That would be if we only had one photon that struck a detector. That's not a simultaneous event. That'll be thrown out. If we have scatter of one of those photons so that the two detectors that detected these annihilation events don't accurately represent where the scintillation really occurred, that would be a paired event, but a bad paired event because of this scatter. And we can find these guys, we can identify them, once again, because what happens when this photon is scattered? Its energy is degraded. If this detector here can represent that energy degradation, we can correct for that. If we have two photons coming from, or two single photons coming from different scintillations that fire two detectors at the same time, that would be a pseudo-paired event, but is not an accurate temporal paired event. So these random events typically happen in very high count rate areas, so we certainly want to adjust in PET imaging the count rate so we minimize these. And again, a good event is simply two photons being detected in near simultaneity with one another and the origin along that axis being identified spatially. Another thing that we want to try to do with scintillation detection is to account for attenuation, soft tissue attenuation. Well, we can do that by generating transmission images at the same time we generate emission images. Some gamma camera have the capability of producing a image of the emission photons coming from the patient and at the same time, or even in a subsequent scan, produce a transmission study that comes from a source of radiation that's outside the patient. These transmitted photons strike the detector, and now what we have produced is an image that represents the relative attenuation patterns in the patient. So we have an emission image, we have a transmission image, which then tells us something about the relative attenuation values across that field of view. That transmission image can be produced by an external radiation source or more commonly produced now by an X-ray tube. So we're actually producing a CT scan, sort of a poor man's CT scan, that we can then correct for these areas of high attenuation in our emission image through the reconstruction algorithm. So it's a really valuable technical technique that's all based upon producing both an emission image as well as a transmission image. Now, we could also produce an image that is a map of the scatter characteristics of the patient. In other words, we could have a look at the energy spectrum coming from the patient and produce an image of photons that are coming from the area of Compton scatter. And we can enter that image of scatter into an algorithm that assesses the emission data as compared to its scatter characteristics, as compared to its transmission image to do attenuation correction. And those images can be really dramatic. Here's the raw emission image of a strategy. In this particular case, we are using external sources that are lined up with each of these two detectors so that we produce this transmission image, we produce a scatter image, and then we produce a scatter corrected image. You can see these little halos around the high count rate areas where this scatter correction algorithm has been employed and get a much more high quality image based upon this idea of correcting for Compton scatter. Now, the key thing that produces more impact on your clinical accuracy and image quality is really the collimator that's used. There are certain standards in these correction in the number of photomultiplier tubes, the thickness of the crystal, and the correction maps that are all done at the point of manufacture. But the collimator determines the field of view that you can image. It determines your spatial resolution. It determines your sensitivity, which is the counts per unit activity that you're measuring, and it also may determine the amount of image distortion. How these collimators work? Really pretty simple. We have holes, we have septa in between the holes, photons moving from the source to the detector that move in nearly straight lines with holes, pass through those holes, and strike the detector. Photons may also be attenuated as they travel at angles, or if they strike the detector at strike the collimator at the end of a hole. But suffice to say, as this source moves further and further away from the face of this collimator, this angle over which we can accept scintillations into our detector increases. That decreases spatial resolution. So with our approach to collimation, the key thing to remember is to minimize the source to detector distance. Make it as close as you possibly can so that we eliminate as many as we possibly can these photons that are traveling in angles that still are able to strike the detector, albeit at adjacent holes corresponding to the collimator. Typically, in nuclear cardiology, we're using parallel hole collimators. As the name implies, the holes are in parallel with one another. The septa between the holes are made in reproducible thicknesses so that the absorption across the field of view gives us reproducible values. And a parallel hole collimator will give you a one-to-one correspondence in size of the object to the image. In other words, there's no minification or magnification. These collimators may vary somewhat in the shape of their collimator holes. They can be round or they can be hexagonal, but what's critical for you to remember about them is that their image attributes are based upon the diameter of the hole, the length of the hole, and the thickness of the septa between them. As the hole gets bigger, you expose more crystal face to the field of view or the flux of radiation. That improves the sensitivity of the camera. More counts per unit microcurie it's exposed to. When these holes decrease in size and the septa increases, then we have better spatial definition of the photons as they strike the crystal, which improves the spatial resolution. So with parallel hole collimators, the thing you want to think about in that collimator's response to radiation is the ideal response, which is a pristine photon originates here and travels at some presumably low angle from its point of origin, goes through a hole, strikes the detector. A bad situation would be a photon that's scattered in the patient and then strikes a hole that does not correspond with its origin. But we can still identify this guy once again because he's been energy degraded through this Compton scatter phenomenon, and that can be independent of the collimator's response. But here's a phenomenon that does happen. And by sheer luck of the draw, by probabilities, some photons will go right through the septa of a collimator. All right? They're photons that are coming from outer space right now that manage to go through the atmosphere, manage to go through this building, and are irradiating us with natural background. Some of those photons can actually go all the way through the Earth. There's nothing that says that every photon that's generated in nature is always attenuated. It can be, by the luck of the draw, not interact with any of the atoms of matter in which it's exposed to. So we will have some septal penetration in collimation strategies, and that will, of course, decrease spatial resolution. Parallel hole collimators are usually classified by their energy. All of you guys will be using energy collimators that are classified at 200 keV or below, because thallium and technetium both fall below that energy classification. They will also be classified by their spatial resolution. What is the minimum distance in 2 points in space that they can resolve? And by sensitivity, how many counts per microcurie of activity they produce. They have sort of qualitative names like low energy high resolution, or LEHR, low energy all-purpose, LEAP, or low energy high sensitivity. Very easy to remember. If you look at the ASNIC guidelines for nuclear cardiology for myocardial perfusion studies, you'll see that the recommended collimator for both thallium and technetium is the low-energy, high-resolution collimator. All right, you can use low-energy, all-purpose collimators with thallium, but you can't use those with technetium. So when you see these terms, understand what these terms, LE for low energy, and then the HR, high resolution, all-purpose, or high sensitivity for the actual optical characteristics of that collimator. How is all of this related to the system performance? Well, the system resolution squared is equal to the sum of the collimator resolution squared plus the instrument, the intrinsic instrument without the collimator, which would be the crystal photomultiplier tubes and all its associated electronics. In other words, the intrinsic attributes of the instrument are related this way. So you can see that any little advantages you can get either through the electronics, the scintillator, and the photomultiplier tubes, or those intrinsic elements of the gamma camera coupled with the collimator attributes will improve your system resolution. So you'll see this equation in a number of different forms on the board exam. Just remember that system resolution squared is equal to the sum of the squares of the individual resolution or performance characteristics of a gamma camera. This is the most critical thing to remember. Look, as a function of distance of source to collimator, what the loss in resolution is. As distance increases, the resolution, as indicated by full width half max, significantly goes down in both high resolution collimators and general purpose collimators. This blue area here represents about 5 to 15 centimeters, which are typically the distances that the detector is from the collimator, organ that you're imaging, the heart. And you can see that there's a significant loss in resolution just due to that distance. So any questions regarding collimators that you see on the board exam, remember that as distance goes up, resolution plummets dramatically. Sensitivity and distance don't have that relationship. As the detector is moved further and further from the source with a parallel hole collimator, you do not see significant differences in sensitivity, because as that distance increases, you simply widen the range of angles that photons can still strike a hole and strike the detector. So don't be fooled by any questions that try to equalize the optical effects of sensitivity and resolution as a function of distance. Sensitivity will not dramatically change as the distance increases. Resolution will. So you always want to make sure that that distance is minimized in a clinical situation. There's some non-standard collimators that you should be aware of, and I've listed the names of them here. You've got some, the names of these collimators reflect the hole geometry. They're slant hole collimators, diverging, converging, pinhole, a number of different collimators, but overwhelmingly what you guys will use and be tested on are parallel hole collimators. Another attribute of collimators that you want to be aware of is that we might be moving away from lead collimators. When we have photoelectric absorption of photons in the septa of a lead collimator, what's going to happen as a secondary radiation from that photoelectric absorption are characteristic X-rays of lead, which are 72 keV. Which plops down right in the middle of the photopeak counts that you get from thallium. That would obviously be an image degradator. So we may see some movement towards tungsten collimators, which produce characteristic X-rays that are of different energies when used with thallium. So that's about it for the technology development. Most important thing to remember is that for all types of collimators, the resolution is best at the face of that collimator. For sensitivity, There are a number of things that affect the number of counts you see in an image per unit activity it's exposed to. Certainly the energy window of the gamma camera, the wider that energy window, the more counts you'll get. But the type of collimator, whether it's high sensitivity or high resolution, which is basically the hole diameter, will determine what that sensitivity value is. And here is a critical thing you want to remember. The low-energy general-purpose collimators, or all-purpose collimators, you'll see it written both ways, produces about 300 counts per minute per microcurie of activity. A high-resolution collimator produces about half of that as a sensitivity value, 150 counts per microcurie. The acquisition times for the imaging protocols that are in the ASNIC imaging guidelines, which is a great study guide, by the way, can download those from asnic.org, download the imaging guidelines, and it'll tell you how much time for every one of the clinical protocols your acquisition time is, will be based on the low-energy, high-resolution collimation. So you want your collimator to be somewhere near a sensitivity value of 150 counts per minute per microcurie of activity. So changes in those sensitivity values may not detect just problems with the collimator, but they may detect changes or imply changes in sensitivity of the whole instrument. But it's critical to remember what those two numbers are. So if we increase hole diameter, what do we do to resolution? We decrease it, but we increase sensitivity. If we increase the hole length, which narrows that range of angles through which photons can strike the detector, we increase resolution and decrease sensitivity. If we increase septal thickness, we probably produce very little change based upon what we do to hole diameter in resolution, but we expose less of the crystal face to the flux of radiation, so we decrease sensitivity. And as we increase source to collimator distance, we decrease resolution and probably employ no changes in sensitivity. Now, that known, how do we do quality control of gamma cameras on a day-to-day basis? And this is most likely what you'll be tested on the board exam, is your awareness of these quality control procedures that test these various factory settings for image correction or for system corrections, as well as collimator performance. I want to give you a couple of terms, two of which are the uniform field of view and center field of view. Useful field of view is defined as 95% of that crystal face. The center field of view is 75%, the center 75% of the field of view of the camera. You can bet that the camera manufacturers will optimize the performance of the gamma camera for that center 75%, or the CFOV of the gamma camera. That's why you want the object that you are imaging to be near that center of field of view. Now, we know that most gamma cameras exhibit some non-uniformity. We add those corrections, so in a test of system performance or in a quality control program, we will test both the useful field of view and the center of field of view. Uniformity refers to the ability of the gamma camera to produce a uniform image of a uniform flux of radiation. We will measure that in two ways. We will measure the integral uniformity and the differential uniformity. How do we do that? To measure integral uniformity, we will look at the greatest variation on a pixel-by-pixel variation over the entire field of view of the camera. So we'll acquire an image of a uniform flux of radiation into a 64x64 matrix. We do allow for some smoothing to get rid of statistical noise, and then we'll simply look at the difference between the maximum pixel and the minimum pixel and divide that by the sum of those, the minimum and maximum. That will give us this pixel by pixel variation. And this is what it looks like. This is a rectangular field of view.
Here is the center field of view demarked by the red line. The yellow line represents the useful field of view. In that integral equation where we look at pixel by pixel differences, divide by the sum, and convert that to a percentage is in the center of field of view, 4.7 in this case, and 5.6. You will uniformly always see better performance of the gamma camera in the center of field of view. This is a detector that's out of specification. You'll see that its values are significantly higher than 5%, and you can even see the non-uniformities that are in that image. Something has gone wrong with one of those system correction factors, and our quality control program has brought that to our attention. Differential uniformity looks at a pixel by pixel variation, but only over a very small portion, usually a 5-pixel area in the digital matrix. And so the output from the gamma cameras for this type of quality control or this type of assessment look very different. And the next speaker will actually go into some detail as to the mechanics of how you do this. But here we see the pixel with the highest value, with the lowest value, and then we see a group of 5 pixels where we have the greatest range of values. So in differential uniformity, we take that highest variation over a small pixel area and divide that by the sum of those two. And you'll see that these values will even be lower than that magic 5% that we saw with differential uniformity. How do we do that on a day-to-day basis? You want to position the gamma camera in the same position on a day-to-day basis. You put a point source at a distance of about 4 times the useful field of view. So if the useful field of view is 10 centimeters, you place a point source 40 centimeters from it, and you set up your energy windows just like you would for a clinical study, and then you acquire an image for about 2 million counts and record all of the values associated with that, the activity that you use for your point source and the amount of time that it took. And that's basically all you do. Then you apply those two equations to what you get from that image. The spatial resolution is a little bit different. The procedure can be done intrinsically, that's for the camera without the collimator, or extrinsically, which is with the collimator intact. Most of the states and most of the regulatory bodies will allow you to do intrinsic measurements on a day-to-day basis or on a weekly basis. Some regulations, however, will mandate that you do collimator resolution studies, but these can be done either on a 6-month or on a quarterly basis. You use test patterns that you place between the source and the collimator, and these test patterns assess the resolution in both X and Y directions. This is the most commonly used, and this is the one that will probably show up on the board exam. It's called a four-quad phantom, a hunk of plastic with lead bars at known distances and at known thicknesses from one another, arranged in 90-degree orientations from one another. And you simply take a picture of this test phantom, and you look at the image that you got, and you compare the values qualitatively that you see in the image to what you know to be true on the four-quad phantom. There are other phantoms that are usually parallel holes or orthogonal arrangements of holes rather than bars that can also be used. But this is most commonly the four-quad phantom, which is used to test spatial resolution. The results of this are qualitatively assessed only. So the technologist simply looks at them. If they can see all 4 bars and all 4 of those bars look straight, then we know that the minimal resolvable line and bar spacing is intact from the previous day, and that would indicate the appropriately performing gamma camera. Spatial linearity. Well, as you know, we have to do a lot of corrections to correct for the nonlinearity that's inherent in photomultiplier tubes. That usually translates in imaging to the inability of a camera to produce an image of a linear array of activity. So spatial linearity needs to be tested, but if you use that four-quad phantom and the bars are straight, you're really testing resolution and spatial linearity at the same time. But there are phantoms that will cover the entire field of view of the camera and give you a picture of what the entire field of view's inherent spatial linearity is. There are some failures of this, and if you look very carefully, you can see that these bars tend to diverge or curve away from the center or converge towards the center. These would be representative of cameras that are losing their nonlinearity. If you have a gamma camera that was made prior to digitization, which was about in the year 2000, you may see some of these effects in your quality control for linearity. Sensitivity. Well, if we are acquiring these flood images every day that we use a gamma camera, and we know how long it took to acquire 2 million counts, and we know how much activity we had in the point source, if you think about that, you have all of the data that is required to calculate sensitivity, which is the number of counts per unit microcurie that you get in a measured image. So whenever we do the uniformity test, if we record the total counts and the total amount of time it took to get those counts, as well as the activity of the source, post facto to doing that, you can easily calculate the sensitivity in units of counts per minute per microcurie of activity. Energy resolution is, as we discussed, a reflection of the ability of the gamma camera to accurately convert those energy interactions in the crystal to flashes of light and then subsequently to electronic signals. And we do this by, acquiring an energy spectrum on a gamma camera. And every gamma camera has a button that your technologist can push, and it will calculate or map out or graphically represent the spectrum. And you can then calculate that full width half maximum of the principal photo peak and compare that to the one that came with the gamma camera at its point of installation, or you can compare it on a day-to-day basis to see if those values are reproducible. So again, that full width half maximum is a very effective tool in allowing you to compare bell-shaped curves, which are what the energy photo peaks of the energy spectrum are. Lower the number is better, but in imaging, not only is the lower number better, the reproducibility of that is better. So in summary, what do we do for quality control? The uniformity we do on a daily basis, resolution we do on a weekly basis, linearity we do also on a weekly basis. These other values related to collimators we will probably not be tested upon because they're based upon some state regulations which may have some variability as you go from state to state, or whether or not your laboratory is accredited by the American College of Radiology or by the Intersocietal Commission on Accreditation of Nuclear Laboratories, ICANL. There are a couple of things that are specific in quality control to SPECT. You know, we've really just been talking about the camera in a fixed position, but we know that high-quality SPECT based upon the ability of this gamma camera to produce reproducible data as it rotates around the patient. So we have a couple of things that we want to make sure we test in addition to the planar quality control mechanisms to ensure good tomographic quality control, and that's uniformity and center of rotation. And now we want to look at the uniformity of the collimator and the gamma camera as a function of its orientation around an object. If we have a uniformity defect in this orientation, when the collimator is, or the camera is looking at a source from this orientation, and we move that gamma camera to this orientation, that defect will be in a different position. So as we move the camera around a source and we have a uniformity problem, it will produce not a single spot of non-uniformity, but will produce these lines of uniformity. In a real-world situation where we do about 64 images around a patient, these lines of non-uniformity that are in our reconstructed image become circles. Those circles are called ring artifacts. So associate ring artifacts with a non-uniformity in either or both the gamma camera coupled with its collimator. They're very difficult to see on reconstructed images, but you normally try to identify them in the transaxial orientations, and you look for these curved lines of either increased or decreased counts that are outside of the object that you're trying to image. Very difficult to see, and frankly, not that prominent in modern cameras in their performance. The other thing that's specific to tomographic image is center of rotation. The reconstruction algorithms, as you'll hear about later, imply that the gamma camera moves in a perfect circle around the object that it's imaging. They don't. We want to calculate what that center of rotation offset is, and we do that by looking at the shift in the position of a point source in an image as a camera moves. If we have a perfect camera and we looked at just a camera at 0 degrees and 180 degrees, we would see that these two points would be in exactly 180 degree mirror images of one another in the field of view. And in fact, in all angles, we would be able to see that. Well, that doesn't happen. We know that these cameras don't move in perfect circles, so we test that through a center of rotation correction where we simply take a point source, we move the gamma camera around that point source and do a tomographic acquisition of it, and then we look at the shifts in the position of that point source relative to the center of rotation. Remember that in a 64 by matrix, this will be the center pixel and this will be the center of rotation. It should never vary more than 3 millimeters. And the gamma cameras have a quality control procedure that will show you where that position of the point sources are as a function of that rotational acquisition, and it will shift or move those points through a center of rotation correction algorithm, and you really want to make sure that that's done at least on a weekly basis. How do you detect it? Kind of hard to detect. They look like motion artifacts. If you see motion artifacts, these wings and the disconnected septum and free wall in your myocardial perfusion patient, on every patient on any single day, you probably want to think of center of rotation errors. They will be consistent on every patient, and of course, motion artifacts are not. And remember, they're best seen on the transaxial data, and they're really difficult to assess on multi-head systems because one head may be different from another. So in summary, we want to do these routine quality control procedures based upon what is required by your accrediting body and what's required by your license. Older systems will exhibit more problems than newer ones, particularly at this 5-year break. And artifacts in SPECT will be very subtle to see on the reconstructed images. Okay, so now you know the theory behind what all these shortcomings of a gamma camera are and what the theory is in testing how well those system corrections will work. We'll move on to our next speaker now, who's Robert Pagnanelli, from Duke. He's the chief technologist at the nuclear cardiology department there. So he lives and breathes these quality control procedures on a day-to-day basis, and he will show you the very specific things that you have to do to ensure an appropriate quality control program. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Robert. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Lindsay. Hey, Dr. John.